Boston at the Sheraton for the One Mind for Research meeting, the Next Frontier of the Brain Forum, imagining the next decade of neuroscience research and development. We've been talking about lots of aspects of neuroscience. There was a session just finished this morning on emotion and motivation. One of the speakers, welcome, Helen Mayberg, professor of psychiatry and neurology, imaging and therapeutics, Emory University School of Medicine. Your talk was exploring the neural circuitry of depression. How large an issue is this?
Well, I think it's the paradigm shift of thinking about depression as a circuit disorder rather than just a psychological or even just a chemical problem or a chemical imbalance. And I think over the last 25 years, the leveraging of advances in brain imaging has allowed us to test that by actually saying we've got a variety of signs and symptoms that smell and sound like locations in the brain, and to actually ask the brain if that's true or not by studying depressed patients and seeing what's wrong. And we can take advantage of PET measures of metabolism or blood flow, and now we can look with functional neuroimaging at how mood is regulated or how treatments impact the dynamics of the brain and see if that hypothesis is true.
The whole concept of social cognition, some of the numbers that were thrown out yesterday about the number of people suffering from brain diseases, disorders, afflictions, and so on, those are huge numbers. I mean, this is obviously a moment that time is ready for this, right?
Well, I think what's really fascinating is it's always been a big problem. The fact is we haven't been wanting to look at it, that we've relegated the study of mental illness to back rooms. People have suffered quietly. And it's just like we saw with Alzheimer's disease. You know, you had a senile family member. You didn't talk about them. You didn't bring it out. You certainly didn't look to raise money or figure out that this was somehow not the same as an abnormality, that this was somehow just more than getting old, that these were diseases. I think the same thing is depression, personality disorders, things other than bipolar or schizophrenia, which are so clearly different from normal life, that depression is involved to where actually it's not okay and it's not normal to actually be in a state where you suffer from such psychic pain that you are virtually paralyzed. And that isn't a reaction to a bad experience in life. That actually recognizing that these are illnesses, that when the brain goes wrong, this is the phenomena that's produced. Not that when your world goes wrong, these are just the reactions of your brain. That the brain is a driver as well as the reactor. And this is a dynamics. And I think we've just gotten to where we've reframed what we're looking at. The problem is that life is difficult, and that the normal reactions of the brain and how we cope can sometimes be confused with when the brain just goes wrong and can produce the same phenomena. And teasing that apart is, I think, what modern neuroscience and modern psychiatry is trying to do.
So fMRI was a game changer then. I mean, you're an expert in neurology of depression, right? I mean, how does one explain to a lay audience what a depressed brain looks like?
Well, I think, again, the idea is just like Mark Raichel said during his talk, the brain uses a lot of energy just to be in the present moment. And what happens when parts of the brain whose job it is to be ready to do whatever life throws at you suddenly hijack the rest of the brain, take over the resources, use more or less sugar, make them not in the ready position to react to the world around you. Once you start to frame that you have access to the brain machinery, both in its resting state and when it's trying to do something, then you can tackle an illness like depression from a totally new way. And so the idea is that your brain is wired to have areas whose job it is to react to your environment and decide if it's good for you or bad for you. But if suddenly the very machinery that might come online to make a decision about your environment comes online itself and says, this is a bad thing, but nothing has happened to provoke the response. Even when you're sitting doing nothing, suddenly you can feel bad. And the question is how do we dissect that, deconstruct that, and look at that in the brain? We use the patients themselves to help us to understand that, and we leverage the technology to look at the brain at rest, to look at the brain in action, to look at the brain as it's responding to a treatment, and actually let the brain tell us where the action is.
So can you actually find, I suppose they'd be called biomarkers, right? Those signals of impending problems and so on. How do you do that?
So the issue is that the way it's been done to start is to take people who are ill, and to see what's going on in their brain. And then to take people who are ill and change them by treating them and seeing how you can make it better. And to use different kinds of treatment, whether it be therapy or medication, and look to see, is there just a final common pathway to wellness? Or in fact, are there different components of the system that respond to one treatment or the other? And so that one can actually move back and forth between illness to wellness and use the treatments we have to try to dissect that. That lays the groundwork for saying, what is vulnerable about a person when they're well? Can I now challenge them to understand why they may be at risk to get sick again? That lays the groundwork for saying, how about family members or people with a particular gene or some other situation to understand how does your brain respond differently than a person who has no risk? And so it is a messy sometimes, but forward and backward approach between starting for the illness, starting with the patients, trying to be as systematic as possible to figure out which parts of the brain and which systems are more specific or not to the illness itself.
So a rather broad question here, and maybe there are, the statistics are always a bit dodgy, but is there any indication from what you've read of globally different trends in numbers of people who are said to be depressed in any given population?
Well, you know, the numbers tend to be done on more developed countries, and the numbers seem to be across the board in the same ballpark. One of the most fascinating things about the absence of brain markers or biomarkers is the fact that the word depression doesn't exist in all cultures. So what people even complain about is different. We've already learned through work in Western countries that men don't complain about sadness like women do. Their depressions can present with irritability and other kinds of symptoms like anger. You know, it's not the word that comes to mind when I think about depression. So our narrative itself can get in our way, which argues for the point of we need, not to oversimplify, but we need ways to interrogate the brain so that we know we're talking about the same problem in all these people, whether it's in an undeveloped country, a developed country, so we have a common language so our treatments can be developed to what we're trying to treat and not to the narrative.
Yeah, I was just thinking, on the plane out here, I actually picked up Time and Newsweek. The Time cover was What Makes Powerful Men Act Like Pigs.
And don't ask me. I don't know.
The Newsweek cover was The Good Wife 2012, What's a Candidate's Wife. So I'm thinking about gender differences, all right? It was just
fascinating.
In depression, gender differences, sex differences?
Sex differences, gender differences are well described. And what's fascinating is in children, there's no gender differences. But then when you reach puberty, you get the larger proportion and incidence in women over men. Now, that data seems to be holding up quite well. The contribution of sex hormones and the contributions of changes in women's cycling has certainly been an area of research because peripartum, postpartum depressions are quite profound in vulnerable people. Mm-hmm. And clearly the role of hormones are part of this story. And I think that how that will play out in terms of genetics or other risk is yet to be determined. But there is no doubt that women are at higher risk than men. On the other hand, I think once the neurobiology at the brain level is known, maybe part of that reflects what the complaints are. and that is it as dichotomous as it's appeared to be there. Depression in men is certainly a considerable problem. When you get into late life, again, the segregation of the sexes is a little more concurrent. And so again, there's something very important about fertility and the contribution of hormonal cycling in women that certainly seems to aggravate and be a contributor to this, and it's an important clue in studying women's mental health and the higher incidence of women over men.
A number of the pieces written about you that mentions there's always some reference to deep brain stimulation. Could you explain that and how that fits in?
So, you know, my motivation over the years has been to take a neurologist view and define a neural circuit of depression. But as this story has kind of laboriously unfolded over a long period of time, enter in the fact that as you start to characterize a circuit, and as certain elements in the circuit become more salient players, the question is how can you modulate the circuit more selectively? And that's really leveraging what was available from brain stimulation for movement disorder. So I got into depression by way of movement disorder. My first studies were on stroke and Parkinson's, kind of using the Parkinson's experience and the Parkinson's model, the less heterogeneity of people with Parkinson's, where I could match every element of their illness except for the presence or absence of depression, mm-hmm. to decide if it was even worth pursuing. And to go back to the fact that you can very precisely modulate one of the elements of movement disorder, Parkinson's, the motor components, and actually not touch the mood or cognitive elements of depression. We said, well, we've got a circuit for depression. So why don't we see if we can modulate our circuit in the same way that they modulate their circuit for Parkinson's disease? So it's really an idea that was really just taking advantage of what was already available. And so we had a hypothesis about a very important area of the brain in all of our studies, this Brodmann area 25, the subcolossal cingulate, mm-hmm. and said it's got a very interesting wiring pattern right around it that talks to all the other areas of the brain we think are important for depression. Maybe we can tune it right there. My neurosurgery colleague, Andres Lozano in Toronto, and my psychiatry colleague, Sid Kennedy, put our heads together and came up with a protocol and said, we want to go right here. And so we tried it, and it worked. And, you know, surprisingly so. I mean, not only, you know, you never try anything aggressive like that unless you actually have good reason to think it should work, but you never actually think in your mind, what would I do if it did work? And like many things, it never happens quite like you expected. I figured it'd take some time to tune the circuit to see the changes in behavior, and it turned out there were things that happened right in the operating room in a way that's made me fundamentally think differently about depression and even how to define it.
Do you also talk with memory colleagues, though, people who talk about, you know, anxiety, the amygdaloid, the amygdala, and so on and so forth? I mean, what's the connection between, what's the highway between depression and anxiety? And what's the...
Well, you know, it's fascinating because if you talk to the animal modelers, we're in the same neighborhood. Yeah. We're actually in the same house in many ways. And it kind of tells you it's not just about the real estate. It's about the trafficking through the real estate. So it isn't just where in the brain with its associated chemicals. It's actually the rhythm of the brain that may turn out to be the ultimate answer. That the rhythm in anxiety and the crosstalk between this ventral medial frontal cortex, amygdala, hippocampus, that's so important for anxiety, for fear conditioning, for PTSD, is the same set of brain areas, but in a different rhythm, a different crosstalk in depression. Talking about the same areas of the brain, we have wildly different narratives, patients' experience. And I think it's because I think depression is an arrhythmia. I think you're stuck in an abnormal rhythm. I think that PTSD and anxiety is your responsivity, your acute reaction to stimulus is altered. Depression is you're stuck in the same subroutine over and over again, and stimulation pops you out of it. And the question is understanding the nature of that arrhythmia from a brain point of view. And there are models for that. It's electrophysiology. The imaging, the PET scanning, the fMRI we've done up to now has told us where. We've been able to get the wiring diagram, get the network, and now what's going to carry us forward is understanding the physiology, the rhythms, the oscillations, the coherence. And we can use, particularly with stimulation, more than other technologies, to understand how do we, in essence, cardiovert the brain? How do we get you out of a malignant rhythm into a, not a normal rhythm, but a less abnormal rhythm that now you can use other interventions, including the patient's own capacity to learn to their best advantage. Mm. And you can't do that unless the rhythm is set up to allow you to do that. So the next frontier is defining what that rhythm is.
I actually remember the exec NSF-funded Science of Learning Center at UCSD called the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center. Mm-hmm. And we sort of jokingly say, well, timing is everything. And I have a conversation on the Science Network with Yuri Buzhaky, whose book, of course, is called Rhythms of the Brain. So this whole notion of timing and rhythms and...
It's, as a neurologist, bias of neurology is where? It's a wiring diagram. It's lesion deficit correlation. That's the history of neurology. Psychiatry is about the narrative, back to Freud, but also about chemistry. The part that we all know is it's all about rhythms. But in order to study rhythms, you have to know what rhythms to listen to. And so it is the interaction of the narrative, the physiology, and the location that I think will allow us to deconstruct this problem. But in fact, to me, the thing I need to know now is about timing and rhythm. And now with the opportunity of being in an operating room, being able to listen to the brain, what does that mean? You place an electrode in someone's brain and you don't just introduce current, you can listen to current. You can listen to what the brain is saying. And then you need a translator. You need someone to uncode that. And that is the skill of the rhythm readers, the timing readers. And so to me, the future in our ongoing experiments is to actually get at that millisecond level timing and to understand what happens when you stimulate. What did you do at the rhythm level? We know kind of what we did at the gross matrixscopic functional level. What area increased its blood flow, decreased its blood flow? How are they wired up? Now the question is, how are they talking to each other differently? That's a timing question.
Now, what's the traditional treatment for somebody who's depressed?
Well, it's a combination of things. I mean, for many depressed patients, focused cognitive behavioral therapy, interpersonal psychotherapy, now mindfulness, are evidence-based treatments for many depressed patients. Alternatively, if you're a pharmacologist, you say, no, we have medications that are very efficacious. Most of our work is saying everybody's right. The question is, not everybody given a drug responds, not everybody given therapy responds. Mm-hmm. We don't treat a heart attack by asking patient preference. We do pictures of their heart in order to know you treat one vessel stenosis with a stent, but you treat five vessel disease with bypass grafts. It's not a negotiation with your cardiologist. It's evidence-based toward getting you the treatment that's best for you. So with depression, it's the same thing. We're learning through imaging that, yes, everybody can get well, but people don't get well on the same thing. So how do we optimize what treatment is best for you? Well, we can do experiments with imaging and saying, take a scan, randomize people to best evidence-based treatments, say drug or a particular drug or a therapy, treat them for 3 months. If you get well, go back to the baseline and say what predicted how you did. And what we're now learning is all depression is not alike. We always knew that, but now we're actually seeing there are types of brain states that actually are optimally treated with therapy, and there are other brain states that are optimally treated with drug. And if you actually get the kind of treatment that matches your brain type, you will have a greater probability of actually improving the first time we treat you. And that, I think, is a future. So we're using the imaging and the things we've done so far to say, how is it that we match people up to the treatment that we need? And so it isn't just about brain stimulation. You know, putting wires in people's brain in all depressed patients is not the goal. Mm-hmm. You don't want anybody to have wires in their brain if you didn't need to. And I'm hoping the brain stimulation, what we learn from that, can be leveraged backwards to say, what is happening with stimulation that we can simulate with a drug? We're going to learn about what systems we're affecting, what combination of pharmacology we're impacting, that the future is going to be about how to understand and deconstruct those findings to coming up with better drugs. On the other hand, those patients are in a state that's very different from a more first episode or more routine depression. And in fact, people have said, well, I used to think maybe actually by our experiments, we'll actually be able to identify the first time you're ill, that maybe if you were going to go on to be the malignant form of the depression and need DBS earlier rather than 5 years later. And it turns out that it's a malignant transformation for the people who require DBS. Our best patients were people that when they first got sick did fabulously well on whatever treatment they were given, that over time they lost the ability to respond. Something morphed, something changed, the dynamics of the brain was altered to the point that they were in the really malignant state that required this extreme intervention. Mm. So this notion that there are types and you just need a way to identify it early on, no, there's that part of it, but there's also the idea of understanding how does an illness evolve? And I think it's a hard but tractable problem. So we have treatments, and I'm encouraged from our latest work that in fact we'll be able to subtype people and get them the first time to a treatment that increases the probability that they won't have a 35% chance of remission, but they'll have a 65% chance of remission. And that's where we live now.
Do you actually, did you actually do any training in psychiatry as well as in neurology?
No, I'm kind of a wannabe psychiatrist. I mean, when I was always attracted to the brain. So I was a psychobiology major at UCLA in the early days before they called it neuroscience. And I was interested in major aberrations in behavior, as we all were in the early 70s. And the question was, I grew up in a family of doctors and scientists. And the question was, what was the avenue in medicine to study the brain most effectively? I tried to be a psychiatrist. I didn't like the language. I needed more order. Mm. Neurology was a much more attractive discipline, even though they were really not very interested in higher order behavior then. I trained in medical school at a time where there wasn't even a CT scan yet. We got our first CT scanner when I was a third year medical student. You could schedule a stroke patient 3 weeks from now to find out where the stroke was. I dallied with being a neurosurgeon. I didn't have the patients for the operating room, but I was always interested in the nature of how can surgery really treat patients, mm-hmm. because there's an orderliness to it. So I found my way slowly how that neurology was a language that seemed rational to me. How could I apply the neurology of language of neurology? How could I apply the language of neurology to the problems of psychiatry? And imaging came along and gave me the tools to do it. And then, so many years later, to actually go back to neurosurgery to test my hypothesis. It's been a very interesting road.
I usually ask people how they got into this business, but the answer in your case seems to have been, you know, your family, parents, scientific.
Well, my dad was a general practitioner.
Yeah.
My uncle was a scientist. And so I was exposed to the combination of the importance of taking care of sick people, but the optimization of taking care of sick people by research. And it was always discussions, because we were a small and close family, my uncle and my dad, to actually think about how you get beyond the status quo. And so I always was attracted to science, but always pulled toward medicine. And since I wasn't a good enough photographer, which I loved, or musician, which I loved, or writer that I loved, I mean, science and medicine seemed a way to combine creativity, service, and take care of people that had problems that needed to be solved.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, is there anything else that you would have liked to have been if you hadn't been a scientist? It sounds...
If I could have been an artist, a real artist, I
do you dabble?
Not anymore. My husband's a photographer, so I dabble through him. But I like pattern. I like looking at things. I think aesthetics in the world is incredibly important. And it's interesting that I've gravitated to depression. I don't really know why, except that what I have learned is that it robs people of those ultimate creative instincts and spirits. And so I think that science is the ultimate creative art, that good science is about seeing something that isn't quite there and creating something that moves in that direction. So in some ways, good science is good art. But if I could really choose, my mama often used to say, how wonderful it would be to be an opera singer. Well, maybe not an opera singer, but, you know, a different life. But there's nothing more gratifying than the process that we do with through our work.
It seems to me enormously difficult to put yourself in somebody else's neurons and actually think what it's like to be experiencing what they're experiencing. Have you ever had been depressed so that you know what it's like to be depressed?
I mean, no, that's a very interesting question. No one's actually ever asked me that. I don't have depression. I think being a good physician, I think the reason physicians need to do research is because you become the closest in learning to listen to a patient and what their experience is, to for a moment be in their shoes, but have enough distance. It's always learning what that proper distance is so that you can be a good observer, a good caregiver, but actually hear the experience to model it as a scientist. There are times where, because the language of depression is not of the cortex, it's of the subcortex, I'm convinced. There are narratives that patients use, but I think it is a narrative. It is not the experience. It's very different from when you have intense pain at a place in the body on the surface. You can describe it in exquisite detail, point exactly where it is. You listen to a depressed patient, it's always metaphorical. It's as if I'm drowning. It's as if I'm suffocating. It's as if the pain is here. There's always the as if. I think it's because it's not a cortical process and they're trying to describe it. And just like William James said, it is a psychic pain and an experience not known to normal life. And that you can't know, and I know I can't know what it is because I've never experienced it. And it's my job to get as close as I possibly can to listen exquisitely carefully to try to channel that and model it scientifically. But in fact, by not having the experience, I often think that if I knew what that felt like, really, I could do a better job.
There's an interesting profile in the New Yorker this week of the physicist David Deutsch. And in the part of it, he talks about being a great fan of that television series House. Mm-hmm. And he makes the point that what's so good about the way House is played is that he's solving problems, not necessarily dealing with patients. I mean, so there's a distance, the sort of thing you were talking about there, that if you get too emotionally involved somehow, it's a curious contradistinction here, isn't it? That you sort of feel that you could, if you had this enormous empathy because you'd suffered the same thing or felt the same thing, and yet you need the distance.
No, you know, the key to science, even when you're trying to solve these very you know, problems, you know, when you're with one patient, it's that patient's problem. They're not interested in the group study, the evidence. It's about what you can do for them. In order to be an effective science, you have to be scientifically agnostic. You actually need to care enough or have an idea enough to set up the hypothesis and test it. But you really need to set up the null hypothesis and be willing to fail. And there's a difference between being a scientist and being a pure clinician. And when you do both, you have to find a balance so that you are an advocate when you need to be, but when you're doing the experiment, it's not the time for advocacy. It's a time for unabashed, the data speaks. And so, but in order to decide on what is the salient question, what's the important and meaningful thing you want to solve, that I think involves, you know, the interaction between a doctor and a patient to understand what is the part of the problem that I think I can contribute to, and how do I dissect it, how do I solve that. So I've used or tried to use my instincts and my empathy, but also take everything I've got to put up the wall of scientific objectivity, because otherwise I can never solve the problem and I don't do anyone any good no matter how good my intention. You know, the Dalai Lama said, I mean, and it's a quote that I'm probably kind of altering, you know, you have to set up the null hypothesis. Don't ask a question in which you can't do it. Don't try to test the existence of God because you can't prove the negative. Same thing in this. You can have the very critical suffering of patients in mind, but you have to distill it down into the part you can solve and the part you can't solve. And as you solve one piece of it, you actually come to realize that there's a whole other layer now of new questions that you see very, very differently because you actually focused attention on a very narrow component to start.
Mm. So a question I ask people who have labs and so on. Peter Medawar's old book, Advice to a Young Scientist. What's your advice to a young scientist?
Be curious, be objective, and do what speaks to you, not what other people tell you you should do. We live in a time now of lots of market forces telling us what we ought to do. There are many, many profound problems in medicine and neuroscience. And again, I'm a doctor, you know, and I choose a very small area to think about. And I could, like all of us, could be drawn to, you know, where the money is. The question is you, all scientists should say, what is the question that I want to solve? And then work to figure out what are the means and the trajectory to get there. And to listen. And to listen to others and to realize that even people that you might disagree with have a lot to offer because, in fact, we're all looking at many of these problems from different orientations. And it's like a big giant puzzle. You may be in the right corner of the puzzle and have several pieces put together, and you can't see the relationship to someone else. But, in fact, over time, the pieces will come together. And so it's always monitoring the outside world and one's, you know, other people in your field, but actually following your own instincts and always setting up the hypothesis and being willing to fail.
This meeting, this bringing together of a huge number of people for a moonshot for the mind, as Patrick Kennedy called it, and it has with it a document. It was a 16-page, 10-year plan. There's a 62-page version of it too. This thrust at this particular time, why now, do you think?
I think because the problems are profound. I think that it's nice to see a mobilization of an effort so that one realizes that individual scientists aren't alone. Everyone in their own struggle is not alone. We are at the greatest time for neuroscience research than we've been in the history of the world. And we're also at a very complex and difficult time in the history of society, mm-hmm. both economically and with scientific resources. We're in a state of change. And so it's wonderful to see this kind of mobilization with everybody on the program says, yeah, I get that. And I think it's about realizing, just like patients have said at the meeting, to realize you're not alone. To actually realize that we are, this emphasizes that we have to be listening to each other that much more. That individual labs can make tremendous progress, but crosstalk between labs can make more progress. And it's a leveraging expertise. No one can be an expert on everything they need to know anymore. And it's actually realizing that we can harness collective expertise in ways that we move into different dimensions on how to solve these problems. And it's the only way. And, you know, we've been doing things and making great advances, but we're kind of on a plateau. And we need different ways to solve the problem now. So why now? Because now's the time.
When he took office, President Obama said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place. What is the rightful place of science in the society?
I think science is about progress. It's the ultimate test of kind of truth. That science is necessary because facts are facts. Data is data. You can't manipulate it. Well, you can manipulate it, but there is, if you look at it full on, data basically tells you the nature of the world. And without actually a true understanding of the real nature of the world, and whether it's physics, whether it's biology, whether it's mathematics, that we are rudderless. And I think that science will always hold a very fundamental place in society. What magnitude, I don't know. I don't make those decisions. But it is an ultimate truth that you can't massage or come up with a soundbite for. And I think that that makes it very important. And when we get into health, if we get into saving the environment, when we think about basically our own existence, at some point, scientific truth has to be available.
So, in terms of a woman in science, I keep on asking this question of whether I should retire it, keep asking it, and they all say to me, no, keep asking it. It is harder. It was tough to be a woman in science. I mean, did you find that? Or?
Yes, I mean, I think that when I went to medical school, there was 22% women.
Yeah.
I think it's hard for everyone in science, but I think it is hard for women. I think that society, we're supposed to do everything. I don't have children. So in fact, it's much easier for me. I think the balance of having a full life and doing all the things in life that we all want to do requires prioritization and distribution of our time and effort. Science is a full-time job. It's never done. Being a mom is a full-time job.
Yeah.
And I think that for women, particularly women who have children, that making those prioritizations has got to be extremely hard. But I think even beyond that, I think that that colors a lot of what goes on in this. But I think that problem solving, I think science needs committed and smart people. And men and women are equally smart and can have different views of the world and what the priority of questions should be. And so I think that we need to work to make it possible for people, no matter what their other obligations and priorities are, to have their input to the system, and to welcome it and to come up with new ways to do that in more effective manners that allows people to be everything that they choose to be and not to give up anything.
Do you have any sort of historical heroes? If I gave you a time travel token and said you could bring anybody to dinner, anybody that you came across in your career you thought, oh my gosh, I wish I could have sat down with that person and asked them a question?
I think Leonardo da Vinci is really? One. I think I am attracted to the number of things he thought so profoundly about. And that's, I think just from a personal point of view, he sounded really cool. Again, that scientific and creative mix is unbelievable to me. In a more contemporary time, I was on the bus yesterday as we were on our way to whatever we were doing last night, and I was thinking about how there are contemporaries that missed the revolution of the imaging and the explosion of the study of behavior, that just missed it, who died prematurely. And so I think of Norm Geschwin, because I'm in Boston.
Right.
And I studied with him as a student. He died kind of in the year before I was going to be a behavioral neurology fellow with him.
Right.
And I realized that the whole trajectory of my life would have been totally different had he not died. I probably wouldn't have done what I did. On the other hand, I put Geschwin in the context of Freud, in the context of Kreplin. I would love to see what people who just observed these behaviors, cataloged them, thought about them, would make of the scientific revolution, what their contributions would have been, how we would be thinking about the brain if they had these tools.
It'd be kind of fun to sit Mark Raichel down with Freud.
Yeah, that would be, I would pay to be at that dinner. I would pay to be on the wall at that dinner.
Yeah.
So, I don't have, scientific heroes per se, but that in fact one has to have perspective on the fact that we are very privileged to live in this time, to have these tools, to ask these very questions. People have been asking these same questions, well, since Hippocrates, at least in the term of depression. And, you know, they had it right back then. They just didn't have the tools to test their hypotheses. So we have obligation. You know, we can't dismiss the past. We need to harness the past and actually test their views of things, because those were the ultimate observers. They couldn't pop somebody into a scan and let the brain talk to them. They had to listen very carefully, and I think there is a lot to be said for that.
Okay, last final question. What are you optimistic about?
Ooh, I need some sleep to answer that question. I'm optimistic from a scientific point of view that we're going to solve these problems. That I think the idea that people are becoming more cooperative scientifically because they need to be makes me optimistic. I'm optimistic that we can solve some of these very, very hard problems if we just stay with it. I can become very pessimistic about the world, and I try very hard to look at the glass half full side of things. And I think we've got our work cut out for us. But I think that if we stay on target, if we work together, if we take advantage of synergies and relationships and collaborations and actually really live the thought that there are lots of ways to skin a cat, and that we all have to kind of work together and pool our tools, and we'll be successful.
Great. Helen Mayer-Burke, thanks very much.
Thank you.